Good morning on Tuesday, March 31st, 2015. My name is Brian Medden, and you're listening to BrianMedden.com podcast. I'm sitting in my house in San Francisco. Joining us via Skype from our studio in San Francisco is Jack Medden.
Good morning, Jack. Everybody.
Gabe is with us from Omaha, from his home.
Good morning.
And from up in the hill country of Texas with 100 megabit fiber literally running directly to his desk is Mr. Ron Oglesby.
Howdy, everybody.
How long is that fiber run? Because I feel like, weren't you in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, I'm kind of up in the middle of the nowhere, but the county I live in is actually a pretty high-tech and pretty affluent county. And they happened to partner the town, the county, and like Google partnered to run fiber next to all the roads. So I've only got about 150-yard pull from the road, so it's, you know, not all that bad.
Oh, wow, and you got 150 yards of fiber just laying around probably, too.
Oh, so. Yeah, you know, I went into the garage. It was right there next to the, you know, the auger and all that fun stuff.
So, your gator and your other gator.
So for those listening, we did this last week. We had Jarian on last week. And
he's awesome.
Yeah. It's these shows, you know, so we're doing sort of just a weekly podcast, what's going on, what's happening in the news, but we also just want to bring in one guest each week and just to just find out about what, kind of what they're up to, what they're seeing in the industry. And so Ron, I mean, you know, Gabe and I have known you, you know, comfortably over 10 years now. I think we're probably...
Oh, at least. God, had to be what, 15. Since 99, 98, right? Oh, in that time frame?
Even when we didn't know you, we knew of you because... You know, back in the late 90s, we knew Brian and I worked in Cleveland, and we knew this guy named Jim Kenzig. And Jim Kenzig started a mailing list for support for Citrix environments called the Thin List, the thin.net. And like there were a few rock stars in that list that posted all the time and answered everybody's questions. And it was like Ron Oglesby, Benny Trish, and Rick Mack. And I'm sure I'm leaving off some other ones too. But like, so we knew of you to the point where, I mean, I remember when I first met you at, I think it was Citrix iForum in like 1999, I'm like, holy shit, this is Ron Oglesby.
I have those moments with other people, you know. That was trying to fill up my time in my inbox with thin.net messages and, hey, look, I got nothing to do for an hour. I'll sit here and read all these. And, it, you know, the funny thing, if you guys remember about that time, there were kind of two places to go. There were the Citrix support forums, which were like based on notes or something. And then there was the thin list. And there was a point where Citrix went in and they revamped their forum. I don't know if you guys remember this, but it was like me and Jeff Pitch, who you guys know and works with me now. And they revamped their forum. And all of us guys that had like tons of posts lost everything. We all went back to zero. And I I'm never going back to that again. And I lived in the thin net after that.
I remember there was a Yahoo group or something, too, that Barry Flanagan ran. But other than that, I mean, the Thin List was the place where everybody went anyway.
Yeah.
We had Thin Planet was another site.
Yep.
And they, for a while, spun off the ASP Island.
ASP Island. Oh, my God. You know, it was so funny you bring up ASPs. I was actually searching for that acronym the other day in my head. You know, it's like as I get older, my brain needs to re-index periodically or something. And I'm sitting there going, someone was telling me all about how they've got this customer and they're going to take all of his desktops and they're moving them all to Azure. And it's all going to get moved and all this. And they've figured out how they're going to package the apps and they figured out their builds and they figured this out and that out. And they tried Amazon. And I'm like, oh, okay. Don't you have, you know, a data problem? Well, what do you mean? I go, you know, the data is still in their office, right? And you're putting all their desktops up here. How fast is that connection? Oh, well, it's a VPN. I'm like, well, that you have the same problem that, and I couldn't remember. I couldn't say ASP. I couldn't, my brain wouldn't index through everything. And the guy goes, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, you remember all those companies that, you know, bought a bunch of hardware and tried to build desktop centrally back in the late 90s, and then they all went bankrupt. And he goes, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I hung up.
FutureLink. Come
future
on.
FutureLink. That's FutureLink.
But it's a different FutureLink. But, you know, so over the weekend.
Yeah, other FutureLink.
Over the weekend, my girlfriend and I went to the Madame Tussauds Wax Museum here in San Francisco, which was just.
Did you have guests in town?
No, we were walking. So a friend of mine, you know, we talk about what we do this day, and everyone was always saying, "Well, oh, you guys always have the most fun adventure. Like, how do you do this? Whatever." And it's just literally taking a walk and going where it's random. And she had a moment. We're up on a hill in San Francisco, and she's like, "I really want a slushie right now." And I'm like, "Where do you get slushies? 7-Eleven? Do they have 7-Elevens in San Francisco? I don't know." So we go on the Google, and 7-Eleven, 1.2 miles that way, and we just walk to 7-Eleven and we get slushies. And then, you know, we walk out of 7-Eleven and we're sitting in the little bench outside drinking our slushies, and we look up and there's a billboard saying Madame Tussauds with an arrow, and we're like, "Is it Madame Tussauds here? I've never been to a wax museum. Are they really made out of wax? Can you touch them?" And so we go into Madame Tussauds. And by the way, you can touch them. And they do a cool job because they have props. They encourage you to touch them, take photos, be silly. It's really like a good kind of interactive – well, to the extent you can be interactive with a mannequin. I'll show you some photos, though. Like, there's
That's
some
cool.
crazy ones. But anyway, they had E.T. with like E.T. in the front of the BMX bike. And then you could get on the bike and put on a red hoodie and everything. But they had to explain my point here, what E.T. was – like E.T. the Extraterrestrial was a movie from 1984. I'm like, oh my. And there's kids in there. I say kids, they're probably like 20. And I mean, E.T.'s before them. Like, they were not a thing on this planet when E.T. was created. And like, by like 10 years.
Yeah.
You know? Like E.T. was old when their parents met.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know what, it's funny because that's like, you see that in society. We see it in the computer business too. It's that kind of lack of tribal historical knowledge, right? And, you know, that was such a big thing to one generation. But, you know, like you said, kids, 20 years old, they have no idea what E.T. is. And, you know, I see that. I've got a teenage daughter, and sometimes I'll use a phrase, I'll say something, and she gives me that look that I used to give my grumpy old grandpa sometimes. You know, like he'd talk about, well, when you're on the farm, you can't leave the gate open with the pig, you know, and I'd stare at him like, what is wrong with you?
We don't live on a farm, Grandpa.
Right?
Well, you know, we talked about, and this happened with Jack, because Jack, you've now, I mean, gosh, you've been in the industry now, what, 4 or 5 years, Jack?
Yeah, something like that.
And it's funny, you're an old-timer now when it comes to mobile. but we've talked about the days of when Gabe and I met in the 90s and how we had, you know, dial-in internet and we had to have CompuServe, like text files with all the CompuServe lists, you know, local phone numbers and that kind of stuff. And I feel like it'd be kind of fun. Maybe we should do this at Briarform or something for all of us to kind of get together and just recreate, like just write a day in the life. Like what was a day in the life of – you know, Ron Oglesby, IT consultant in 1998.
Oh my God. Land Rovers and Shivas and, you know, WinFrame 1.6 servers with, you know, 800 modems attached to them like an octopus out the back.
So to be clear, he said Land Rover. That's L-A-N, not the car. It's
I wasn't running a Land Rover in the late 90s.
But it is interesting. So, you know, I mean, Ron, you are very well known in this industry. And, you know, we talk about you got started on the thin list and, you know, you've spoken at, I don't know, 10, 15 Bri forums, something like that. And you know, kind of been doing this forever. But one of the things, you know, I am really curious on, I want to talk about what you're seeing now in the industry and what you're up to and trends. And there's a million things. But first, you know, we probably had this conversation over beers and stuff here and there, but like, I'm always curious, how did you actually get into IT? Like, what was the began? It was like, I'm curious about that. And then how you got into Citrix? Cause how does anyone become a Citrix consultant in the 90s?
I've been like a computer geek. It's funny, kind of since I was a kid, and it all started again, another movie that young folks won't remember, but it all started with War Games. You remember that?
Absolutely.
And I thought that was just the coolest thing that he could change his grades online and my grades weren't that great, so I thought that would be cool. And I got into it because my uncle ran a business and happened to have a Trash 80, right, a TRS-80, just like Matthew Broderick, sitting in his house. And I'd go over there and just play with it and read his books. Then later, after I got out of the Navy, and I tried a bunch of different things, right, my dad works in a body shop, so I I painted cars. I went to the PPG school to paint cars and did that for a little while and did some other things. And I wound up just always playing with computers. I liked playing games. Everything I learned about conventional memory was from TIE Fighter, right? I had to get more conventional memory freed up. And I was playing games. And back when you actually went to a computer show and you bought an 800 megabyte. Stuff. Yeah, you bought an 800 megabyte hard drive, and you never thought you'd ever fill it up. And yeah. I built that stuff, and one day a friend of mine, it was funny, he was a cop, funny enough. He was a cop that was sick of being a cop and said, hey, I just got a job at this place called Applied Systems in Illinois. It was a software company, and you know way more about computers than me. You can totally get a job there in support. And at the time, I had a small network. I was working at a shop where they painted signs, like big signs on the side of the road. And I did the design for these signs on the computers and set up their network and stuff. And
what network was it?
Oh, it was just it was like a really, really early NetWare 3.1 network. And all it was a bunch of Windows PCs, Windows 3.1 back then, that were using NetWare as a file server. So I show up for this interview, and basically I took like a 10 grand cut and paid it to become a dude who would answer the phone and say, hello, Applied Systems, large system support. How may I help you today? And re-index DB3 databases and stuff. And the way I got to Citrix was there. I was at that company taking those phone calls. There were probably 100 or 200 people that in their support department. And I was just that guy that I didn't like escalating calls. So I was the dude that would get someone on the phone. They're frustrated. They can't print. They can't, they can't get into this part of a record or something. And instead of, if I didn't know the solution, saying, well, one of our escalation guys will call you back, I would say, can you hold on for a minute? I'll just go talk to an escalation guy. So I'd walk over to one of the guys I knew and said, hey, I'm getting this error. What do you think? And he'd give me two or three things, and I'd walk back and try them and solve it. But one day a printer call came in, and I'm working this printer issue like normal. And the woman on the other end, funny enough, she was from Illinois. She was at an insurance company in Illinois, goes, you know, that what you're doing right now isn't going to work. And I go, why not? She goes, because we're on Citrix. And I thought she said citrus. I'd never heard of it, you know. And I'm like, you're on. Yeah, I'm like, are you on oranges? What are you talking about? And she goes, no, it's a thing called Citrix. And she starts describing a WinFrame server to me. It's a Windows server, but lots of people can log in. And, you know, that's it's awesome, except for printing. Printing is so bad, I want to kill people.
This is like 1942 or something like
that's
that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so I go, you know what, let me go down here and talk. So I go down and talk to one of these escalation techs, and there's one dude in the entire company that's Citrix certified. And I ask him, and I say, look, they're doing these jet direct printers, she says, on, you know, WinFrame, and she can't get it to work. He goes, nobody can get those to work. He goes, so try these things. And I got to where I was the printer dude. If you couldn't print in WinFrame.
I'm sorry.
I know, right? If you couldn't print in WinFrame, they sent it over to me. And that was when, like, I had a really good team lead that came over and, like, was a mentor. He goes, hey, I know you've been talking about getting a cert. This is back when the MCSE was starting to be big. You should go get this MCSE cert. And if you can get certified in Citrix, you should do that. But we're not going to pay for the class. And, like, I went at night and I did, you know, I read all the MCSE books at night and took all the tests and got certified. And then I went and I literally bartered some tools with a guy I knew that worked at a Citrix consulting company that was also running training classes, took a few days off work, went to a Citrix class, and became certified. And when I came back to work after the class, they thought I was on vacation. I hung this little Citrix cert. Remember they used to print them out for you?
Oh, yeah.
And I hung it up on my little cube wall and went back to work. And one of the directors walked by and saw it and, like, lost his mind. Who sent you to class? And I went to class. I just paid for it.
But did you say you bartered some tools?
Yeah, this guy needed an air compressor. I remember because it was an older air compressor, but it happened. It was a decent one with good volume, and I happened to have the water filters and everything for painting cars. And I just happened to know this guy. We'd communicated. He was talking about getting a compressor, and I'm like, hey, you think you can sneak me into one of these classes? And he said, sure, and literally gave me a book and let me sit in one of these classes, and I took the class, you know. It was funny enough, later on I got to teach those classes at one of those VAR consultants when I was teaching Citrix, and I did that for buddies of mine. If you remember after the whole 2000 thing when like Lucent and all these other companies just started laying off IT guys like crazy, guys I knew, I'd say, come take a Citrix class. You'll have work if you can figure out how to get people to print.
Man. That's like your modern day, you know, like Les Miserables story. You know, it's just stealing a loaf of bread to eat. Like, it's a play it forward. You sneak your buddies into class, and
yep.
Oh, that's awesome.
Air compressors must be like IT backdoor currency or something, because I've definitely done a side gig to get an air compressor before.
I did a gig to get a welder.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Oh, no. Hang on. But you were paid money that you used to buy a welder. I was paid with an air compressor.
This is from Lincoln Electric. And back in the 90s, although they I also got paid. But I was like, can I get a welder? And they're like, yeah.
Man.
They're out in Euclid. But so you're the Mr. Citrix Print at this little VAR. This is probably what, late 90s now?
Yeah, like 99, I want to say. It was like 99. And then about, you know, it was so funny because it took me, you know, I tried several things before I got into computers. And then I got into computers and I liked the work. And, you know, you really, let's be honest, you don't have to work too hard. I'm not out there digging ditches during the day or anything.
It's not what my dad would call work.
Yeah, no, my mother for the longest time said I changed screensavers for a living and, you know, stuff like that. So I'm the Citrix guy. I'm at this little VAR. I happened to wind up at a VAR that had a really good rep in Chicago, a decent rep, but had an owner that literally was severely bipolar and would, I don't know, every 3 months just jump off his meds and go crazy. So in like 2001, when every IT org was getting its butt kicked, his was really bad because he was like off his meds and IT was just getting its butt handed after the bubble popped. So I quit and I walked in one day. I said, "Hey, I've had enough. You're insane." I had like $800 in my bank account. My daughter had just been born. And I went home and I said, hey, I quit. That guy's crazy. And my wife looked at me like it was the end of the world. And she goes, what are you going to do? I'm like, I'm going to go get Citrix contracts. And I did. I went around. I had a couple of hospitals. I set up their Citrix environments. For a while, I did Borg Warner's Citrix environment out of some of their Michigan locations for like J.D. Edwards and stuff. And that's when I got picked up. Where you guys really started to know me at like Rapid App. I got picked up at Rapid App and I was there 7 years and we got acquired after the acquisition, right? I'm such a small company guy. I thought it'd be a great idea to go to Dell.
Wait, so Rapid App gets acquired. It's like, this is too big.
Yeah. So I went to Dell. Yeah.
You were in Singapore, weren't you? You were all over the place.
Yeah, I was everywhere. And that, you know what? The funny thing is all the people I worked with at Dell were like really good people. It's really funny. You go there and you have this vision of what Dell's going to be like, you know, when you get there. And, you know, they just, you know, they're hiring huge numbers of people. How quality can they be? Things like that. And it was really funny. Everyone I worked with was just really great people and they were really smart. And, you know, the problem really boiled down to it was this huge company, you know, and if you wanted to make a change in, at the time it was Serververt was big, right? Everybody was ramping up on Serververt, and I kept trying to tell them, look, the methodology you guys are using to identify which servers to virtualize or not and how to talk to customers about it, it's wrong. You know, we've got to tone this back. We've got to follow this process. We've got to introduce these tools, and which is fine, but from concept to actually rolling that out might take a year, right? And I was just frustrated. And then, like you said, they would send me places. They're like, hey, we want you to train some people in Asia on this methodology. Great, let's do it. Okay, well, when we go overseas like that, if we're going to Asia, we like to hit multiple cities. I'm like, great, let's do it. And they go like, okay, cool. It's generally over about 4 weeks. And I'm like, 4 weeks? Like, I'm overseas for 4 weeks? Yeah. You'll be in Tokyo for a week and Singapore for a week. And, you know, then you'll go to Hong Kong or Beijing for a week. And then you'll go to Australia for a week. And those are all cool places and it's great to visit. But they would do this at like, oh, you're going to go the entire month of June. All right, I guess I can do that. And just as you're coming back, they'd say, oh, you know, it was so successful. We liked that so much. How about you go most of July and some of August also? And that's when I said, no, you know, I got family. I got barbecues. There's beer to be drank, you know. And I just didn't like that type of travel. It was just too much work.
And so that was where you were right before where you are now, which is at Unidesk.
Yeah. I stayed at Dell just over a year. Like I said, I love the people. It's just too big of a company for me. I felt trapped. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to get out of here. And I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm quitting. So I quit. And Tom Rose, who's the chief marketing officer at Unidesk, had been calling me for like several months. He'd call and say something. And I'd go, yeah, I'm just not interested in VDI. And I'd hang up or he'd hang up on me or something. And
at the time, I started to interrupt, you were doing more sort of like you had been doing Citrix and then you were doing more server virtualization because you've written some books about VMware. And at Dell, your job was not a VDI job or a Citrix job. It was more of a general kind of server virtualization job.
Yeah, it was server vert and data center, exactly.
Is that when you wrote the book?
No, I did the ESX book back at RapidApp. The first one was Scott Harold and I, the very first one. The one with the funny green ball that we made in Photoshop on it.
Yeah.
And, and that was the first ESX book, right? And it was kind of funny because when RapidApp got acquired and I was looking around for places to go, and I had went and, you know, one of the places I interviewed was VMware and they flew me out and I interviewed for ProServe. They were really trying to beef up their ProServe at the time.
What's ProServe? Was,
professional services.
Professional
consultants, right? What I was doing. And it was hilarious because the first guy I interview with and I meet with, he's got, you know, my little green ball book sitting there and he's like, oh, this was a great thing. You know, we bought a bunch of them or we give, you know, I try to get my guys that are coming on new to VMware. I try to get them this book. I'm like, oh, that's cool. And we're having the interview. And then a second guy comes in, I'm talking to him and he goes, so I was looking at your resume and you've been great. You know, you don't have any education listed in your resume. And I'm like, yeah, I don't. And he goes, so where'd you go to school? I'm like, high school? He goes, no, college. I'm like, I didn't go to college. I took a couple of classes, but this American history teacher was crazy. So I stopped going. And he stared at me. He didn't know what to say at first. He goes, so you don't have a college degree? I'm like, no. He goes, I'm not talking in computers and anything. You don't have a college degree in anything. I go, no, I don't. He's like, you know, I'm sorry. We might as well stop. We can't hire you. And at the time, literally, they couldn't hire me because I didn't have a college degree or something. So I took off. You know, I was like, okay, that's cool. And wound up at Dell after that. You know, the way they hired me, I don't think they cared if I had a police record the way they hired me.
It's funny though, because so, you know, Gabe doesn't have a degree. I don't have a degree. Jarian, we talked to last week, does not have a degree. And so we were talking, I think after the show last week that we were sort of mid to late 90s was kind of the golden era where if you knew your stuff and you had the certifications, I mean, you could, I would say, get a job anywhere. I guess I should say you could get a job at the time pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
But it was good. But
well, so, I had to have, I tried to go to college and it was like a 2-year community, you know, county school or whatever. And so at the time I had this job where I could make $18 an hour. Eight bucks an hour. eight bucks an hour, and they would have paid for me to get the A+ certification, right? So it was like 96, 97. And then I go to school, and I take the entrance exams and stuff, and then they say, okay, well, yeah, so this is, you know, 2-year program. At the end of it, you'll have enough knowledge to have the A+ certification, which at the time I was told, like, all you need is the A+ certification, you know, to have a successful job. So I'm like, so wait, so in 2 years, I'm going to pay you money, and then I'm going to come out of this, and I still don't have this thing that I need? otherwise, I can go to this job where they'll pay me and pay for me to get this certification. Yeah, I'm doing that. So yeah, that's how that happened.
You're right. You know, in the late 90s, everybody was throwing money at tech, you know, because Y2K was essentially going to be the walking dead from what was, you know, what we were told was going to happen with Y2K. And it was the golden age of anyone who was intelligent and willing to throw themselves at learning computers mm-hmm. could make a living. And I think it was an interesting confluence of times because, A, there was this money being thrown at this problem, which allowed a lot of entry into IT. And there was also this there was this group of grown-ups that were in their late 20s, probably around that time, mid to late 20s.
Grown-ups. Those are kids now.
Yeah, they're kids because we're old and we're get off my lawn now, right? But but there was this group of grown-ups that grew up wanting to be computer geeks. People that dug computers at that time that understand what a computer show is, right? No, we knew the ins and outs. We loved plugging things in, and it wasn't just a trade to us. We loved doing it. And it was a great opportunity for anyone who loved doing it and put a motherboard in a big white box, could go get a job and earn a living. And now once they were in it for a couple of years, they're in it for life. These days, I think it's still like that. If you love it and you're intelligent and you have some unique ideas, you can totally work in IT without a college degree. And I meet so many people. One of my mentors, kind of that I still work with, he's at Unidesk now, Rob Zalowski, he has a degree in geology, right? He's one of the greatest computer consultants I ever met, and he's got a degree in geology, you know. For him, it was just, I need to open the door to get into this business.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there's so much talk about the you know, homebrew computer club out here in Silicon Valley from the late 70s, the early 80s, sort of with Apple and IBM and Tandy and Commodore, you know, sort of like that was the sort of home computer revolution. And there's a bunch of people in our generation who were, you know, kids in the 80s who would get these computers and then would start, you know, playing around with basic programming and that kind of stuff. And then it's like there's a whole, like, the second wave of, you know, they built the path for us in the late 70s and early 80s to create these home computers. We grew up watching war games. For me, it was the movie Short Circuit, which is also mid 80s, you know, about robots, but that's what got me into computers. And so we all have similar stories about how we got into computers, but we could actually, we didn't have to be electronics engineers to build the computers. We could get them and do programming. And then, of course, it was way more fun than, as you say, American history or math or whatever we had to do, like, in school. And then it just kind of led us right into, as we got in the 90s, and as you say, the wave of Y2K kind of just created so much money and so much need in the IT industry. And then by the time the year 2000 happened, you know, we had, you know, five, 6 years of experience and could actually go out and get, like, a legitimate job.
Yep. Yeah, no doubt.
So,
and I don't think it's like that anymore. You know, I think these days, don't get me wrong, I think if you have a degree in, I don't know, underwater basket weaving, you have at least checked that mark for some HR crony to look at. And then you're interested in computers, you can find a computer job. But I don't think these days it's generally like that, that just some young computer geek with ambition can just jump in these days. It's a lot harder.
I think you have to be a hacker. You know, you have to be... Yeah. The kind of guy that, you know, jailbreaks the iPhone, that sort of a thing. Like, he doesn't have to have a degree to get a job. But that's a special kind of job that he can get now, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, so Unidesk, so you mentioned Tom Rose. So I had dinner with Tom and Chris Midgley, the mm-hmm. CTO, in, I want to say it was April of 2009, and in Boston. And they were talking about, I think Unidesk had not yet launched at that point, or I might be getting my years wrong, but it was early on in our Tech Target time, which happened in the end of 2008. And, you know, they were talking about this thing they were doing, and I don't know if we use the word layering. I know layering is it means a lot of things. And Ron, certainly you've spoken a lot and written even on BrianMadden.com about, well, you know, what is layering exactly means different things to different people, all that kind of stuff. But anyway, yeah. But the sort of the vision of Unidesk was this was for, I mean, I was looking at it in the terms of like Citrix servers and VDI servers, basically, yep. Where you could take all your applications and sort of install them and slice them up in different pieces and kind of enable and disable applications on demand. And that vision to me, I mean, I told them at the time, I think I very literally said this, like I had just sold the company to TechTarget. But I literally said, like, if I needed to go get a job right now, I'm calling you guys.
Yeah, it's you know, and you're right. They weren't even calling it layering at the time. I think they called it containers or something. And internally, we called it layers. But everywhere in the product, it said container, I want to say. Container or some other weird word. But you're right. I mean, that's the cool thing about layering. And I think that no matter what layering product we're talking about, whether it's, you know, Unidesk or if you look at what Citrix is trying to do with their PVD, which is their old RingCube acquisition, or what VMware is trying to do with AppVolumes now, the goal is that we're all still striving for what we thought we were going to get when SoftGrid came out, right? That I'll just have an operating system and just an operating system, and then I'll be able to assign apps to it. And we all remember the big problem with Citrix early on, and still today, is siloing, right? I put this app on this app on this server, and I use AppV to try to reduce the number of silos, or I try to use AppV because, you know, I got to run some ancient version of a browser or Java with this app or whatever. And the promise of AppV was an isolation. A lot of people talked about isolation, and it helped some specific apps, but the promise of AppV that we all saw or wanted to happen was, wow, I'll just assign apps to servers, like you said, and I don't have to worry about it. It just works, right? I'll have one gold image, one OS image maybe, and then I'll assign apps. And what we found was that we started isolating apps that didn't need to be isolated just to try to deliver them differently to the server or to the desktop. And it's a great concept. If AppV worked for 100% of the apps, I don't think there'd be any layering today. Right, there just wouldn't be. And I think all these companies, the big ones, the small ones, anyone that's dealing with any layering today, what they're really striving for is to still solve this app delivery problem. There's how do we deliver any app to a desktop? And how do we make it really, really simple so you don't have to have, like, you know, Rory Monahan or Jerrion or any of the guys that spend their times virtualizing apps. You don't have to pay them to come in. Your desktop guy could do it, right? And that's what I think all this layering all this layering excitement is really about today, is making it simple for the person, the end user, to virtualize an app and making it work 100% of the time versus whatever AppV is 70%, 80% of the time.
Yeah, and because I know at the time also the isolation aspects of SoftGrid in the day, That was sort of an afterthought. I mean, they really built the product as a sort of application delivery mechanism, and then they realized, well, sometimes apps don't work. We can't deliver them on demand if we don't know what's down there. So they built the isolation as just a pure workaround to make their sort of delivery mechanism work.
Yeah, exactly. And then what we all saw it as a great delivery mechanism, right? I mean, we liked the isolation, and it was really cool to watch two versions of Word running side by side, right? Especially when people back then were still running Office 97.
I think Access was our party trick, right?
Oh, Access was the party trick, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but people saw it, the people with vision saw it as a different delivery model, right? And Brian, you used to be an SMS guy. You know what, you know, SCCM and everything does today. You know, if I draw SCCM on a whiteboard and I go back and find some of your old drawings about SMS, yeah, certain things have changed, but the basic functionality of delivering an app, right, bringing a package down, extracting it, executing the install, it's all the same, and it still has the same problems. So people are looking for a different way of doing that, potentially a better way of doing that, obviously.
And so what are you doing at Unidesk? So, you know, today's podcast is just us chatting about industry stuff, and I want to get into that in a little bit also. But you know, you have been at Unidesk for I don't know, 5 years now?
Almost six, yeah. Yeah.
What do you actually do there?
Sometimes it feels like you're at a restaurant. You're the head cook, waiter, seater, greeter, and bottle washer, right? Because you're kind of doing everything. But so chief solution architect is kind of funny. It almost, when I first heard it, it almost sounded like a made-up term, and I think they did make it up. But so my team, the guys that work for me, the solution architects, they're kind of like your pre-sales SAs, pre-sale SE guys. They do demos. They help customers, you know, how much storage do we need? You know, oh, I've got this problem. Can you tell me what it is? We help them identify that type of stuff. And obviously, the guys on my team do integration testing and other integration work. Like, hey, do we integrate with V Workspace? Well, no, we don't automatically integrate, but one of my guys can write the PowerShell scripts to automatically dump our desktops into V Workspace or whatever. Stuff like that, primarily a lot of pre-sale stuff. And then the training department also falls under me. Me specifically, I've kind of got my hands in a bunch of pies, right? I don't do a lot of demos anymore. I do more work with, lately it's been a lot of partner calls with Citrix, with Microsoft, with some of the bigger VARs. And of course, I've been doing all the kind of field testing of Unidesk for RDSH and XenApp, and then Unidesk on Azure and that type of stuff. I guess engineering likes me to play with it first. So they give me all the alpha code, and I set it up and get to run it and give them feedback, and then occasionally get to dole it out to some people out in the field like Jerry and you know, let them install it and hear their feedback. And I do a lot of that, a lot of product feedback, a lot of product testing, and then, you know, partner stuff and roadmap stuff now.
So you still have a lab in your house, or is it all in the cloud now?
It's all in the cloud now. In the new house, I have one server, and I'm really using it almost just for storing videos and video editing, because I shoot a lot of you know, sometimes marketing videos on features, and then sometimes how-to videos for the field. But that's about it. Yeah, everything's in the cloud now. My wife really got sick and tired of the fan noise from the Dells and HPs that I had.
You used to have a pretty big lab, because I remember we had a server crap out on us at Bryform 1 year, and so we just called you. And I think we sent Jack down with like a 98 Volvo to pick up a server from your base.
88 Volvo.
Yeah. And I pulled the server out of the rack. Yeah, I pulled the server out of the rack. Yeah. Yeah, at one point it was next to all my workout gear in the basement. I had to get it as far away from my wife as possible. Excuse me. And
it's either me or the servers.
Yeah. And I had a 42U rack, and I think at one point I had 14 running servers in there, which were a mix of DL380s and Dell PowerEdges. I had a couple of DL360s and, you know, all of various speeds and processor architecture and all that. But yeah, I had a big home lab, and it showed, right? My power company used to send us our bill, and every time you got a bill, it would compare you to your neighbors. I don't know if you've ever seen this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it would go, oh, hello, the Oglesbys. Did you know that you use 68% more power than your average neighbor? And my wife would freaking look at me with those lizard eyes and shake the bill at me.
Did they think that you were running a grow room down there or something?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I had to put them in the basement and lock them in my weight room, because at one point they were in my office. And if you close the door to the office, first off, it'd get nice and hot in there. But when she'd go in to do bills or something and sit at my desk, she'd hear these servers. And I was out of town one time, and one of them had a fan failure, so the other fans all sped up, so it got really loud. And she just went over there and hit the power button. She didn't care, man. She's like, I'm just turning that one off. And I'm out on site, and I'm trying to do a demo, and I'm like, I don't know why I can't connect, you know? And
So you mentioned, you know, doing integration testing with like XenApp and that kind of stuff. So where do you guys find Unidesk now? I mean, because, yeah, you mentioned, you know, Citrix bought RingCube, and they've got their sort of personal virtual disks. VMware bought Cloud Volumes, and it's, you know, now called App Volumes. Yeah. Are people still using Unidesk in you know, with XenApp and Horizon and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, you know, XenApp's kind of a newer thing for us, because we're just releasing support for it here in Q2, actual production support, like we'll fully support it. So it's kind of a new expansion for us doing the XenApp thing. And it's, you got to think from a company standpoint. Like, if I don't look at it from a geek standpoint, if I look at it from a business standpoint, you're selling to a different group of users or a different group of buyers, if you will, right? If you look at the VDI market and you look at Citrix and VMware, it's really funny because you go into a Citrix shop, and I mean a Citrix shop, they are XenApp first, right? Mm-hmm. They go, we get better scalability, we get better density, we don't care, someone is not allowed to install anything, screw them, you are getting the apps we give you. And then we've got this little VDI thing on the side for those one-off use cases and the guys that gripe. If you go into a VMware shop, it's complete opposite, right? They are a VDI first shop. And, you know, so we, having ran and partnered with VMware for so many years, we haven't sold into XenApp environments. They ask different questions, right? We have to train our salespeople differently. We have to get our support understanding even the language, even though it's kind of architecturally similar to VDI. They have to learn a completely different language for XenApp. And what I found interesting, and you know, on the Citrix side, obviously they're testing and trying to take some code from RingCube and their PVD and turn it into an application thing. They recognize the problem with XenApp too. I mean, you still go into a big environment, and not even a big environment, go into an environment that has 50 or 100 Citrix XenApp servers. We know they have 5 or 6 or 10 different silos. That means 5 or 6 or 10 different gold images. And when you run into the upgrade problems, like from, you know, XenApp 6 to 7X, and they have to rebuild the image, put in the new, you know, XenApp VDA, recertify all their apps on it, they want a better way to do the apps, right? So they're looking at layering for that type of stuff. And we're hoping to expand into that. RDSH with pure Microsoft environment, and of course, XenApp on the Citrix side. That's kind of our new hotness, if you will, in this quarter. And then, of course, after that, and we're demoing it at Microsoft Ignite and stuff, is some of the cloud stuff, CWC on the Citrix side and Azure on the Microsoft side, obviously.
And so you guys, I know the Unidesk product, I mean, it works at the sort of hypervisor level. So it's sort of dynamically building up like the disk that's presented. And that now is, it was originally with ESX, and now that's also for Hyper-V that you guys use.
Yeah, yeah. You can kind of look at layering as there are, there's really two types of composition, if you will, when you're dealing with layered desktops. One is what we do, which you could call offline or out of band, let's say, right? We're just what you said. Everything's a layer. The OS is a layer. The apps are a layer. And you just connect in and go. And we build everything, and it boots the machine, and it looks the way it's supposed to look. Hopefully I didn't lose everyone there.
No, I'm still here. Gabe just said in the chat that he's gone. But
Well, that's that whole Oklahoma thing, right? He doesn't have fiber to his house.
Omaha.
Sorry. And then you've got the ones that talk about snapping on late, right? So you look at an app volumes or at Mocha 5. I don't know if they're still doing it or not. Liquidware Labs is attempting to do the layering, right? The hot add of the layer. And the trick with all that is you're making trade-offs, right? We trade off today that we build the machine and it boots so that we can do everything, right? And their hot, shiny object is, hey, I'm going to attach this hot. And you make a trade-off in that, right? If you're attaching a boatload of layers at login, what's that do to login performance? Or what's that do to processing happening on that machine when you're logging on? And of course, you don't want to hot add anything to a XenApp server, so that's all VDI, et cetera, et cetera.
A quick side note, you mentioned Mocha 5. Did you see, like, that company may have shut down yesterday.
Now, that's what I heard. I saw some tweets about it, and, you know, I heard, oh, you know, is Mocha 5 out of business? And, you know, that made my ears perk up. I'm like, really? They're out of business? But I haven't heard anything credible. I haven't heard from someone I know that knows somebody that works there or anything like that. But, yeah, that would be odd, you know. Mocha 5 has had some cool ideas, you know, over the last 5 or so years, but it was also always a question for me of what are they doing, right? What is their goal? Because they changed directions several times, right? Didn't they have like their own hypervisor for a while?
Yeah, I mean, they were doing, because everything they did was always, because they had similar layering or whatever you want to call it. Everything they did was VM management in Type 2 hypervisors. And I always liked Mocha 5. I mean, now Citrix and VMware are kind of getting into this with the players and stuff. But the basic idea is, for me, it was a perfect BYOD solution. So, you know, bring your own laptop. It can be Windows, Mac, whatever. And we're going to give you a work VM. And the work VM is locked down super tight, which is fine because you've got your actual host laptop to do whatever, you know, Facebook and whatever people do. And they did have a bare metal solution. Their bare metal solution was just using like a Linux, you know, sort of bare metal.
Yeah, it wasn't. They held off on calling it a Type 1. You know, it was
It
was fine because they're like, dropping our disk installs and. But
they did have they had that their one of their primary products was what you were talking about, Brian, where you could set up policies and, you know, send out the image and manage the image centrally, and that was real cool. And then their big thing was what Gabe was talking about, just short of a Type 1 hypervisor. And didn't they license their layering to someone too
for like OEM? Quest.
The Quest, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was always so odd to me. It's kind of like if you try to be great at everything, you know, are you really not good at anything? And I always wondered that about them because they had a lot of cool ideas, and I was wondering which one they were just going to, you know, hold on to for dear life and ride it. But it doesn't seem to happen.
They kept taking on money, too. I mean, they had several rounds of investment.
Yeah. Well, and you know, sort of therein lies the problem, where they – my sense is that they took on so much funding, and you know the people who provide the funding are looking for, you know, 2, 3, 4x multiples.
Yeah.
And so I think they took enough funding that they made the price for them to be acquired just too high.
How do you get more funding then? I mean, if that's the case,
it's the next
they
idea.
They took on $16 million late last year.
Yeah, it's the next idea, you know, and it's and I'm not speaking specifically to Mocha 5 because I don't know. I actually hope they're still in business, right? I've met those guys, and they're smart guys and they're nice guys, and you hate to see anything end, but it's the next idea, right? This we've had troubles with this, or we've had troubles with that, and you're talking to the board, right, which is made up of your investors or representatives from your investors, and you're saying, okay. Here's the next idea, right? We're going to go to this Type 1 hypervisor, or we're going to go to X, and here's what we project, and here's the research we did, and they get the next round of investors based on that next idea and the projections from it, and the investors agree, yeah, that looks like it's going to work. And, you know, a lot of VC-backed companies don't make it. I mean, that's just the way it is. Generally, if you can get a couple of rounds, you're showing that you've got a good idea, and people continue to invest in you, that generally shows you've got good idea and good thoughts.
Well, the thing is, you don't know. So all these press releases about funding for companies, we don't know what their valuation was. And so to Gabe's question of the $16 million last year, you know, that could have I'm not saying about Mocha 5, but you don't know if that was like a small amount so late in a company. That could have been like a lifeline funding, and they, you know, sold half the company to get that.
Generally you don't hear about the valuation, right? It's not like Nutanix, who went from, you know, a Volkswagen to a Lamborghini overnight, right? Where the valuation is a huge thing to them. And it's something, don't get me wrong, it's something to advertise and be proud of because it shows
it's big,
that the company has so much momentum, so quickly. But you're right. In the small companies, you generally don't advertise the valuation.
So on Mocha 5, I got emails from two people yesterday who I know personally who told me I was terminated, as was most of the company. Looks like it's being taken over by an unknown entity. John Whaley also tweeted over the weekend that he was leaving. And so he was their CTO and one of the co-founders.
Yeah.
John's wife recently died of cancer a few weeks ago, and I say that he tweeted this, so it's I just can't imagine
how that goes. Yeah,
what he's, you know, going through it, and I mean I certainly wish him the best. He was a super nice guy. Come to lots of Bride Forum, spoken at Bride Forum, and did a lot of videos with us and stuff. So he's leaving, and you know, on to the next thing he said in his tweet. And so I don't think anything's happening because he's leaving, but if it just looks like it's just one of those things. Like, there's a lot of companies in our space who've had great ideas, and for, you know, I mean, once Citrix and VMware and Microsoft and all the big companies, once they sort of have a, I'll call it, layering solution, even if it does, like, you know, we can talk all day about why, you know, Unidesk is not PVS, but if the money people are coming to think, we already bought one of those, we don't need another one.
There's a lot of that. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to try and see if I can find anything more. I sent a bunch of emails out to people today, but I haven't heard back on anything yet.
Well, it's one of my favorite sayings, right? The best technology doesn't always win in the technology business, right? And you know, if the best technology always won and stayed forever, we'd all still be running NetWare file servers. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. So let me ask you. So Unidesk has been focused on VDI, I mean, for the past, you know, 5-6 years.
Yep.
What's your sense on VDI? I mean, you know, you're an old school Citrix guy, and like me, I think if I can speak for us, like, when the VDI thing came to be a thing, we were like, this is weird. Why not use Citrix? And obviously it's caught on over the past, you know, 8 years and stuff. But just, you know, you're out there more directly connected to customers. And obviously it's going to be customers who are using Unidesk, so they're at least a little somewhat enlightened in terms of what they're trying to do. Right. But, like, what are you seeing out there with VDI? Do you feel like, is it catching on? Is there still things that need to be solved? Is it, you know,
I think technology-wise, you know, the problems have been solved, right? You know, and VDI went from problem to problem, right? How do I manage them, to the disk I/O problems, to, you know, oh, the video's not that good, so now we're, you know, talking about high-end GPUs and VGPUs and stuff. And I think that one of the things that, if you're looking at it from the outside, you have to understand that the organizations that and the people that make decisions to buy VDI versus ZenApp or RDSH, a lot of times the reason they buy that is because it is simpler, right? You might not get the density that you do with ZenApp, or you might not get A or B, whatever it is, but it's simpler for them to deal with. They understand the model. They understand the one desktop as one user model. They understand how the desktops work. They don't have to think about, okay, when an app is installed in session host and its keys are duplicated because multiple users log on and then we've got to populate. They don't have to think about that. So I think what you'll see going forward is that you'll continue to see VDI. You'll see VDI in the cloud, right? You'll see it in Amazon. You'll see it in Azure. And the idea will be that some organizations will drift to that for, A, the specific technology needs. I need individual instances for this reason. And others will drift to it just because it's simpler and they can understand it. But there will still be people that and organizations that say, no, ZenApp first. We have the talent. We have people who know how to use it. And so they're going to use ZenApp and RDSH, and we're going to get better density, and it's going to be lower cost than VDI. And so you're going to see that a lot. The thing that I see in IT today is everybody wants it to be simpler. They don't want to have and retain and pay level 3 people to manage a desktop app, right? They're sitting there looking at their iPad, and the guy's like, well, I just installed an app on this. How hard is it for you to install an app on that? Why do I have to pay a level 3 guy to do that? Why did I have to get consultants? And I think that as these continue to become simpler, the technologies for app deployment and OS deployment, you will still see ZenApp environments for all the reasons we all know, but you'll also see VDI and desktops migrating to the cloud simply because it's easy for people to understand. It's easy for that IT guy that's never done RDSH to go, yeah, I have 100 users in Department X. I spun them up 100 desktops, however they did it, shared or personal desktops, and off it goes. And they can understand it and manage it and all that. And that's what, you know, people are still buying it, and they're still buying it today. They'll continue buying it. I think these cloud companies are going to have to really get and understand the data problem that the ASPs never really understood for some reason. You know, you can't just move a desktop, a corporate desktop with 30 corporate apps with, you know, two dozen servers on the back end and have them over some VPN connection to some office somewhere, right? You've got to have much better links than that. So that'll be interesting to watch.
Now, you know, I did an article a few months ago about this where it's not even just so much the data. I mean, it's all of the applications, that the way they all sort of interact with each other. And mm-hmm. anyone who's involved in anything called containerization or layering knows the complexities of all these apps that are, you know, it's all these chewing gum and tie wire scripts, and this object connects to that object and this here and all that kind of stuff. And I wonder if, because it seems like, you know, the desktop going to the cloud, do you see that on a department level at an enterprise? Because I can almost see how that could be for a smaller or medium-sized company, but I almost feel like if you're going to put a desktop in the cloud, you have to put all the apps in the cloud along with it, or all the apps at that cloud provider along with it.
I think if you think enterprise level, they'll do almost like they did server virtualization. They'll target specific either groups within their organization or a specific subset of a group. And what I mean by that is imagine you're a big bank or a big pharma, and you have 200 users that take complaints, and they use two apps, right? They use email, which we know, you know, you can run a web client anywhere, and they use this complaint app where they fill out some form online, they hit submit, and somebody else tracks its resolution. Really easy to move to the cloud, and they can go, look, I can change my desktop cost from a 3-year capital cost or 4-year capital cost that gets depreciated to a service charge. I move it into an OPEX bucket budget-wise, and I don't have to manage it, and it's two apps and off they go. And then the second thing I see these bigger enterprise type sizes looking at the cloud for is, yeah, there's that. What can we move in there? There's also the DR, right? Big organizations that have big DR requirements have building duplicate data centers for years, right? And hot failover and storage replication and maintaining the links between them. Imagine a place where you go, yeah, we set up a site-to-site VPN, and we keep some domain controllers and some other stuff running up there, so it's always hot, and we do DR there. And we can reduce our DR costs, which DR costs are just insurance, right? You're paying, what Chris Rock called it, in case shit, right? I pay you money in case shit happens. And so I'm going to pay this lower cost thing in the unlikely event that my data center goes down. And then when all the VMs spin up and they start eating CPU and memory, now my cost will actually go up. So they're willing to pay more during the event, but during normal operations, year after year, they could cut their DR cost. I see a lot of interest, especially even on the desktop side, for DR usage for cloud services.
And you see a lot of what you're talking about where it's like one or two apps. I mean, that to me seems like a great use case for RDSH ZenApp model in the cloud as opposed to...
It could be.
Desktop.
Yeah, it could be. You know, like Microsoft's trying to push their Azure remote app, right? It could be ZenApp hosted in the cloud that you manage versus that. But it's also, we go back to that simplicity, right? It's generally not the high-paid IT architect at, you know, JP Morgan or, you know, Ford Motor Company that is told, get these 50 desktops in the cloud, right? He might make a few suggestions, but, you know, it's the one dude who's got to go do it. Is he a ZenApp guy? Is he an RDSH guy? Or does he say, no, I can just spin up 100 desktops? Of course, the cloud model today is all about consumption, and ZenApp or RDSH makes much better sense in a cloud model, because if I have to spin up 100 desktops, well, I could have spun up 3 or 4, you know, RDSH servers, probably with a little more memory, and cut the usage and CPU and memory way down. And guess what? Now I'm paying way less. So I agree that the session host makes better sense, but I think you'll still see desktops going up there for DR and for simplicity's sake.
We're almost kind of running up to an hour. I guess we don't have a hard stop, but I don't want to go too long. But I do want to get there's a question someone asked in the chat about asked if you could discuss the benefits of the newest Unidesk release. for supporting Server 2012 as a desktop OS.
Oh, as a desktop OS. Well, you know, that's, it's not like we did anything really cool technologically with that. You know, the only reason to support, there's two reasons to support Server as an OS within our model. One is to support Zenapp or RDSH. The other is to support it as a single user desktop, and it's licensing. If you're going to do a single user desktop on 2008 or 2012 Server, it's because of goofy Microsoft licensing and what all the DAS providers have figured out. So if you want to say, hey, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to roll out 2012, you're essentially buying TSCALs versus the that old VDA model and all that. That's why people did it. The funny thing is, we were hounded for Server 2008 R2 like the day VMware supported it as a Vue OS.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, yo, man, VMware just called us and they said, you know, you should get on 2008 R2, you know, whatever their talking point to their sales team was for the day. And we were hounded. And, of course, VMware used it as a, yeah, you can't use Unidesk. They don't support 2008 R2. And so for us, it was just a Windows 7 driver, basically, right? We moved it over. We did a couple of things, and bam, it worked. And the interesting thing was we rolled it out, and, like, we have, like, 1,000 customers. And I want to say we've got, like, 2 customers using 2008 R2. You know, it goes back to that simplicity thing. I think a lot of the customers are just, well, I got a desktop. I understand a desktop. I'm just going to put a desktop out there. And then, of course, the more advanced customers, the ones that have been around and aren't scared of servers or RDSH, go, hey, look, I can buy some data center licenses, and there's this loophole where I can make these one-to-one and save some money, and some of those will go and do it.
You know, so how do you feel, like, you talk about this loophole? I mean, you know, you have been one of the more vocal, what do I want to say? Like, just talking about Microsoft and their licensing and their impact the industry and how they can sort of, you know, drive the direction of this while also, like, allowing loopholes to exist. I mean, how do you feel like Microsoft's, where do you feel their head's at now?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's so funny because, you know, now that they're going to that, I think they're trying to jump to that service model, right? You pay every year for Windows, and with their new licensing model where you pay as essentially a subscription.
And per user now too, and not just per device like it was
exactly.
Before.
It's per user, right? That's awesome. Hey, let's go per user, and I can have my laptop, I can connect to a VDI session or whatever. You know, my problem with Microsoft licensing has always been that they essentially just flipped everyone off any chance they got, right? You could, you know, Brian, you and I were at Microsoft together in the MVP days, and, you know, we'd all say it's broken. They would all nod and say, yes, it's broken. We know it doesn't fit.
Were they smiling when they nodded?
Yes, and then the next year you'd be sitting in the same room with the same people, maybe 3 new people, and you'd go, hey, it's still freaking broken. They're like, yeah, we know it's broken, you know, and
it's broken all the way to the bank.
Yeah, well, that's my thing is that I used to think it was nefarious, right? Oh, these guys they're the man, and they're holding us down and all this, and these people don't like VDI, so they're doing it this way. And I really don't believe that. I think that there's some dude in the back with a Excel spreadsheet putting in numbers, and he's the guy that's hitting return. He's got his red stapler there, and he goes, this spits out more money. So, no, we're not changing, right? And that's all it is. And they're finally starting to come around. But like any big organization, it's years in the making, and you almost want to tell them, you know, hey, it's a half effort. You know, it's really a half effort. But maybe with their new CEO and the way things have been changing there a little bit and their focus on the cloud, things will have to change. I think that's the only thing that's the reason subscription is coming, is because they want people to jump into the cloud and they want to make that leap possible. If it wasn't for Azure, I don't think they'd be doing any of it.
Well, and I think it's just because Microsoft is good and ready. Like, yeah, they could have done this a long time ago and made it easy on everybody, but they weren't ready to do it yet, and now they are. So now they're going to be our best friends and actually make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And I mean, it's a clear indicator that they're going to, I think, that they're going to do some desktop solution from the cloud now, too, once Windows 10 comes out. I mean, you know, I think it's just paving the way for that to happen.
Yeah, and you know they've got their Azure Remote Desktop right now, a remote app, which is cool. Hey, I threw a RDSH server on Azure, but again, it's almost a half step, right? Okay, you can get X with these three apps, right? Office and maybe Adobe Reader or something, or you can bake your own image, and that's it, right? Those are the two options. And you're like, well, how does that image get updated? Well, when you want to update it, you have to build a new image and pull it back up, right? And you have to redo it every time. And it's like, come on, you're Microsoft. You couldn't have freaking done better than that, right? I mean, come on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they'll update that one for you if you use all Microsoft software and keep it to low-level, low-end users.
Yeah, exactly.
But other than that, yeah, it's all on you still. It's so it's like we made a Windows Server virtual machine and upload it into the cloud. Actually, it's just like that.
Exactly.
So the opposite of a big company like a big behemoth like Microsoft is Unidesk. You guys are still pretty small and nimble. I mean that in a good way. Mm-hmm. So what are you excited about at Unidesk? What are we looking forward to? You mentioned Q2 for official full production Zen app support.
Yeah, it's, you know, I was pushing this for the last couple of years. It was a running joke inside of, and there was a couple of running jokes about me, but it was one of the running jokes inside of Unidesk that, and we're going to brainstorm, and we're going to talk about features, and Ron's going to write Zenapp and RDSH up there. And it took Don walked in, he had had some conversations with people, and he literally walked into engineering and said, yeah, you guys are going to support RDSH and Zenapp. And they're like, okay. And he goes, and you're doing it next quarter. And then just walked out and left them all sitting there with their jaws hanging. But after that, yeah.
Were you just sitting back there?
No, I got told about it later. They're like, did you do this? Did you put Don up to this? You know, and, but after that, it's the other stuff, right? One of the things that we want to do is, you know, we know that managing our desktops, a lot of our customers just use help desk, right? The help desk packages the apps, the help desk updates the OS and all that. And what I've told this to Microsoft and I've mentioned it to folks at Citrix is that if you want people to use a cloud service, you have to make it easier to manage whatever they're putting up there than they do in their own office today. Right, I don't download things to my phone or to a tablet because I've got to click 8 more times to do the same task on my tablet. I download it there so it's mobile, and so I don't have to open the app, wait for it to open, wait for it to sync, click, you know, on my desktop. I click on the app, it says go, and I click on what I want. And I don't mind a cloud service for that. And one of the things I was trying to explain about desktops and Zenapp servers or any application is that you've got to make it, if you want them to go to it, you have to make it easier than what they do today. And making my own image and uploading it and all of that with remote app, Azure remote app today, is not going to be easier. So I think that layering, whatever the factor is, we think we can do it. We imagine a world where, well, what if you just deployed a couple of our virtual appliances and literally a help desk guy could click on a link that says create a new app layer and it spins up a VM and he logs in, he installs whatever his app is and he says finish, you know, and 60 or 90 seconds later when the magical layering is done, it says, would you like to deploy this to desktops? And if that's easier than what he does today, it's going to make an on-ramp for the cloud. Right, whether Citrix or Microsoft or Unidesk or whoever comes out with it and makes it so that their cloud service, an admin doesn't have to grab ThinApp and doesn't have to set up a pair of clustered local SQL servers and, oh, I need an external load balancer. And, oh, if he goes, well, if I buy this cloud service, I can have my help desk literally go in there and say, new app, go. They install the app. They say save. And, you know, 90 seconds later, they can assign it to desktops in the cloud. Guess what? That's an on-ramp for the cloud. That gives them a reason to move things up there. That's what we see, right? And of course, in the in-between, between everything's in the cloud and everything's local, you've got to be able to manage in both locations. So that's the other things that we're doing is how do you manage on-prem and off-prem in the cloud Unidesk, right? What if you can move layers between them? What if I can have OS and app layers here in my on-prem, but I keep a little tiny cloud presence that my layers get shot up to. And hey, if I have a DR event or if it's Christmas and I got to bring on 20 new sales associates, I hit go and it spins up 20 new ones or it spins up the DR. Everything's there. I'm managing it all the same. And that's kind of what I'm excited about after the ZenApp stuff, which I, of course, think will have a more short-term impact.
Well, you know, that whole vision also now that we're seeing on the virtualization platform level, the sort of integration of like networking and network policy and that kind of stuff. So you could imagine that this little layer, or again, I don't know what we're calling them, that has this app that can work on-prem and off. Yeah. It can also have sort of all the bundle for what it needs for networks and connections and all that sort of stuff. And then it can just sort of run anywhere and sort of work the same way.
Yeah. Or you have these ISVs, right, that are selling whatever their software package is, right? They're selling their software package to state and local government, whether it's ArcGIS or a mapping programs or whatever. What if they stop, you know, saying, hey, you've got to take this DVD and install 800 megabytes of this, and then you've got to install this second DVD to get this. What if they start selling it from the cloud, right? That, hey, yeah, you want our app, you sign up here, and now this Windows app is ported into Windows VMs running in some cloud somewhere, and they pay for that app as a service. Now, of course, that changes their licensing model and all types of things, but even in talking to Microsoft, a lot of the attention that they're getting to remote app isn't like customers running to remote app. It's ISVs talking about, you know, I'd like to put my app in remote app on Azure and just be able to sell it to people that way. And again, it makes it easier to buy. It makes it easier for the end user to use. No infrastructure on site. That's kind of a good thing.
So that's it looks like our job security is strong in that, you know, even this stuff, this becomes easier, and we want, you know, customers, of course, want things just to work, and, you know, you say don't want to pay the level 3 support person to have to support a desktop.
Yep.
But as all the stuff, it's funny to make, you know, as everything gets easier on the outside, the complexity on the back end sort of increases. And I think that's where we're all very safe with what we're doing.
Oh, yeah.
So we run significantly over our sort of planned time. I don't think there's anything else that you want to touch on. We can do this. I mean, if you know, come back, let's, you know, we can make this a regular thing and just kind of continue to catch up. I don't know if there's any other thoughts you have about, you know, that you haven't mentioned about what you're excited about or anything you want to know about or ask people about?
No, not really. I mean, you know, my excitement, we just talked about the short-term and kind of long-term things that I'm excited about. I really want to see how some of this stuff starts shaking out. I will relate a funny that I heard yesterday. I was talking to somebody, and, you know, a couple of years ago, VMware beat up on Citrix all the time about their number of consoles, right? All these separate tools and stuff. And Citrix went through that whole process of kind of consolidating everything and trying to get down to one or two consoles. And this guy was telling me this story that he was listening to the Citrix pitch and seeing their console. And the very next day, VMware came in, they gave him that same pitch about how Citrix is too complicated and has too many consoles. And the very next thing he did was pull up his laptop and start talking about Imidio and App Volumes and Composer and, you know, how there was like four different consoles. And it's really funny watching that all shake out, right? It's VMware used to take a long time to integrate new acquisitions, right? I mean, anybody remember RTO, right? Mm-hmm. How long it took to integrate and all that. And now they've flipped almost to where, hey, we want to get our product on the street. You know, we made this announcement. We want to shove it out there. But what that means is that nothing gets integrated. So it'll be interesting on their side to see how that gets integrated. On the flip side, it'll be interesting to watch Citrix now that they've integrated that and their whole push is CWC, which I don't know if you played with CWC, but literally you don't on-prem install a license server or a DDC or any of that anymore. You just install this little edge server that asks you like two questions and boom, you go up to a cloud session in your web browser and you've got desktop studio and workspaces and you can add apps and all that fun stuff. So it'll be interesting to see if A, Citrix can really pull off that single interface, you know, almost no install, yet it's all the features of Zen App and Zen Desktop. And on the other side, how, you know, VMware will eventually pull all their stuff together into one interface, or if they'll say, hey, screw it, man, you want, you know, five different technologies, you're getting five different interfaces, right? And when they have to come back full circle.
Man, yeah, that's pretty funny how it's gone. It's just completely flipped.
Yeah, it's completely flipped now. It's very odd.
So, okay, final question. You do a lot of public speaking. For those listening, now, you know, this podcast is recorded and goes into our feed, and so goes out to everyone to be listening to later. We're recording this in the end of March in 2015. What's your speaking schedule for the next, you know, few months? If people want to go watch you talk, where are they going to find you?
Oh, let's see here. I'll be at Ignite. I'll be at Microsoft Ignite. I think I got a session or two there. At Synergy, I think we might be doing a customer session at Synergy where the customer speaks and I'll be up there giving support, or I'll be helping them tell their story. And I think we just submitted one or two for me to do with Andre from Nutanix at actually the Nutanix event that's like in Miami in freaking July or something. It's going to be hot. And that's about it. I think that's about it. Not Bryform. No Bryform this year.
Yeah, so you
got to your 10 and stopped.
You know,
I'm looking at the Ron Oglesby bobblehead right now.
You know, it's funny. It's funny because Tom and all the guys at Unidesk are like, oh, go to Bryform and do a session on layering, right? And, you know, I'd like to think that I can talk about layering, not only what Unidesk does, but what a lot of other people do, right? Whether it's RingCube, and I understand what they do in their desktops now, and I understand what AppVolumes does, and I had a decent understanding of Mocha 5. I won't say I was as good at Mocha 5 as everything else, but I would like to say I could talk intelligently about it. And I'd also like to say that generally in that forum, I would tell people, hey, dude, I'm from Unidesk, so I'm kind of biased, but I'm going to try to tell you the truth here. Here's what works and doesn't in each model. But there was like that sense of impropriety, right? I wasn't going to use Bryform as a place that, you know, I grew up in, speaking at Bryform on all types of topics, sometimes positive on technology, sometimes very negative on someone's tech. But I wasn't going to use that as a commercial. You know what I'm saying? So I just stayed away from it completely and thought it was best to not even have a sense of impropriety in that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, we appreciate that. I credit you, I think, as the first person, like when it was Bryform 2005, I think even then you were talking about virtualizing desktops.
There may
have been a session about it, but it was VDI was a thing.
It was called Windows XP on ESX. Mm-hmm. And I did a comparison. I took one of those many lab servers I had, made an ESX server. And if you remember, I want to say I was using an early version of like Login VSI. And I did X number of terminal servers versus Y number of Windows XP desktops running Login VSI. And was basically showing the density difference, right? I'm like, look, you're better off virtualizing session hosts. And by the way, here's the same physical host running local session host, and how many more I got without the virtual. And I think it was those three things, regular session host on that hardware, ESX with terminal servers on that hardware, and then ESX with XP. And that might have been at like the first one.
I think it was.
The first or second one, because I know I also did a ESX versus Zen server thing at that first one and got like angry emails from Zen fans because I talked about their drivers. It was way back when. Way back when, virtualizing XP.
Well, so you know the spirit of Bryform, so we appreciate that. Not, you know,
don't get me wrong. I always appreciated all the free beers and dinners I got at Bryform, but it wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to go out and do a Unidesk commercial. I've got plenty of platforms to do a Unidesk commercial.
As we get closer to Bryform, we should do a podcast where it's just Bryform stories. Oh. There's enough of those.
Brian with the blue hair, Brian's soon-to-be ex-wife showing up at the first dinner, Amsterdam. There's all types of good ones.
On second thought, Ron remembers too much.
Well, Ron, as always, it's just a great pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate you taking the time today. And hopefully, if you want to come back, let's do this, I don't know, every few months or so, and just kind of catch up.
Yeah, it's awesome, guys. Just let me know. I'll jump on.
All right. So that's Ron Oglesby from joining us from his house in Texas. He's on Twitter at Ron Oglesby. We also had Gabe in Omaha, Jack in our studio. I'm here in San Francisco. Justin Meisinger is our producer and our engineer. Mariah Lyons runs our group at Tech Target. So thank you for that. And to all of you, thank you so much for listening. This is show number 66. And have a good day, everyone.